I'm Christopher Lydon, considering with Robert McChesney and John Nichols what Thomas Jefferson would do about the death of newspapers. It would be better, Jefferson said, to have a society with newspapers and no government than one with government and no newspapers. 2 centuries later, though, the papers are disappearing. So what's to do? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about sustaining essential journalism in the digital age. Are new public subsidies in order on the old models of, say, lower postage rates or public broadcasting? Or is the internet already the government's accidental gift that keeps on giving as a marketplace of ideas, an enabler of independent truth-telling, and a wide-open public conversation? Robert McChesney teaches his big vision of journalism at the University of Illinois. John Nichols practices it for the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. Together, they started the website freepress.net, and they've just written The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. Sounds a lot like Thomas Paine, guys. Bob McChesney, would you go first? What's going to revive your patient, the newspapers? And while we're at it, what do you say is the disease they're now dying of?
That's right. An accurate diagnosis is necessary before you can cure the disease. And I think that's one of the reasons we wrote the book, was simply the diagnosis that had been delivered, and the conventional wisdom is delivered, is that the internet and technology has killed the business model for commercial journalism, and therefore it's dying, and we just have to then hope that the patient and eventually the commercial interest or bloggers will come up with an alternative model to give us journalism. We just have to be patient and everything will work out at some point in the future. I think the evidence is pretty clear that while the internet accelerated and made permanent the crisis of journalism began many decades ago and accelerated even before the founding of Yahoo or Google or Netscape or any of the weaponry of the internet and the World Wide Web. In a book, we document the decline in forum bureaus, the decline in journalists, the increase in the ratio of PR agents to working journalists going back to the early 1980s. By the early 1990s, before the World Wide Web was invented, you already had a massive exodus from newsrooms of principled editors and investigative journalists who were deeply concerned about the commercialization and of their craft and the decline of its quality. And so we think the real source of tension is between the private commercial ownership of newsrooms and the public service of journalism. And that tension became greatly aggravated in the 70s and into the 80s when ownership of newsrooms in the United States increasingly became the province of a small number of semi-monopolistic corporations that found the sure way to make massive profits was to lowball the commitment to journalism and to commercialize the news values.
By the 1990s, people like Tom Rosensteel mm-hmm. and others were writing that the commercial owners were taking unconscionable profits, mm-hmm. 30-40% of revenues, even at a time when the papers were declining in energy and power. They were over-milking a cow that was already mm-hmm. dying. Mm-hmm. Didn't it have to collapse pretty soon?
Mm-hmm. Well,
John Nichols.
Yeah, Chris, I think you hit on something that's really vital there. But there's two parts of this coin. First off, the owners, as you had chain ownership come in, the chain wasn't owned by a William Randolph Hearst. It wasn't one guy who had a big ego. These chains were increasingly investor-owned. And
of the Gannett variety.
Right. And here's the key thing, or so many others. Lee, chains you don't even know the names of for a lot of the smaller mid-sized dailies across the country. And their investors, often through a 401k plan or something like that, didn't even know that they owned newspapers. All they wanted was a huge return, as anybody would. This is what they're going to retire on. And so they increasingly were demanding a higher and higher return, 20%, 25%, 30%. It became common with mid-sized dailies owned by chains to be required to send 30 cents off every dollar they made out of the town where they were located, a third of their revenues. And so they ended up in a situation where they had to start squeezing journalism. They had to start squeezing circulation. They wouldn't even circulate in certain areas because if poor people live there, that's not what the advertisers wanted. But that's the one side of the coin, Chris, a really essential side. The other one to understand was that even in this squeezing moment, even in this milking the cow to death moment, there was a desire to consolidate ownership further. And so some of the biggest change, some of the biggest owners went on buying sprees in the 90s and even into the 2000s, where they were buying Metro Daily newspapers, trying to link them up with smaller papers in the area at ungodly high prices. And so to give you an example, a daily newspaper in St. Louis, the Post-Dispatch, sold in 2005, I believe, for, you know, roughly, you know, you're talking in the range of $500 million. It was dramatically overpriced. So then you get the deadliest of all combinations, right? As you're starting to see the advertising decline, driven somewhat by the internet, also by economic turbulence, as well as the increasing demand from investors. And these companies had to service this huge debt. And so the crisis just accelerated. And in 2006, 2007, 2008, we started seeing big newspapers, even not the ones that were closing, but the ones that were staying open, laying off at a rate of 200, 300 journalists a year.
This is the story we've watched in Boston as the New York Times sort of milked the Boston Globe for years and years and years. The cash cows that got milked until they finally died. The question, and go to it, is why save these relics?
Well, we don't think we should save these relics per se. We certainly think the stupidest thing on earth would be to go to Gannett or McClatchy or any of these companies that have run journalism to the ground and give them money and save them. But we need to save, and what's essential here is saving newsrooms, saving the practice of journalism, saving the principle that you need institutions with people who are paid and copy editors and fact checkers and proofreaders and lawyers to protect you and the institutional support to do great journalism. I mean, you need competing independent institutions in a community. The larger the community, the more competition you need, the more diversity you need. And that this is a core principle of a free society. That's really what's at stake here. And how we do that is really the great problem before us. The great political problem that faces Americans in 2010 is the exact same political problem that faced Americans in 1792.
Meaning
that our founders understood that a free press didn't happen naturally. There was no assumption for the first century of American history that if you just unleashed the marketplace, the pursuit of profit would generate sufficient journalism or sufficient news media for a free society to operate. To the contrary, our founders understood freedom of the press to have two components. The first component was that the government should not censor or interfere with the editorial project. And I think we all understand that as the core American principle of freedom of the press. And in the last 100 years, that's been elevated to the only aspect of freedom of the press in the American tradition. But the other core component that the founders clearly understood, Jefferson, Madison, Washington, right on down the list, all of them, was that it was imperative that the first duty of the state was make sure there was a free press system in the first place that wouldn't be interfered with. It was a hollow right to have the right to have a free press if one didn't exist. And they were as obsessed with generating and creating a viable, credible, independent free press as they were with not having it being censored.
You are ready to adopt Dean Baker's idea of a citizenship news voucher, $200 per head or something, that would go to rebuild institutions of a kind of open, public, robust discourse, this kind of ideal that has to be preserved. And people could check off where they wanted it to go. It could be for local news or cosmic news or engineering news or gardening news or maybe sports news. What if it turns out that in this troubled culture of ours, people really wanted to devote the money to Jerry Springer or to learn more about Britney Spears, say?
Sure, that's a great question. Let me just explain it because people haven't read the section of the book yet might not quite understand what we're talking about. One of the things we try to do in our book is say, as we go through an entirely digital future, which we're heading forward at some point, and we're going there pretty rapidly, what can we do to have public funding to support entrepreneurial journalists and newsrooms on the web, but in a way that won't allow any government interference with the content and control? And so this is the great political problem we face. The great economist Dean Baker came up with a plan 10 years ago that John and I embellish, which is the idea, let everyone have $200 of federal money they can allocate to any nonprofit, non-commercial news medium of their choice. And then there'd be a certain way that could be determined by the IRS using their standard codes. And it couldn't – so you could avoid fraud and front groups. And we outline some of the details in the book. It's nearly not that difficult. And the principle would be then that if someone in Boston, for example, or Cleveland in their neighborhood or community wasn't getting any coverage, they could convince 1,000 people in their community to give the $200 federal money to their website. And then you'd have $200,000, but you can get a few people working full time. And the genius of it, in our view, was simply this. Everything that's produced automatically goes in the public domain, so it embraces the logic of the digital world. You pay up front for content, then it's available to all for free. You don't have any barbed wire on the internet. It really creates this vast garden of ideas. It's also extraordinarily competitive, meaning that if, let's say, you were able to raise $200,000 in your community to support three journals, and then you didn't do anything, well, people won't give you the money the next year. Someone else will come along and get it. So you've got to stay at it and do good work and produce, or you're out the door. Third, it doesn't allow any ideological bias by the government. Basically, people can participate if they want, and they get to pick whichever news media they want. And then finally, it allows our philanthropist a really good role to play, because a lot of times people say, well, let's get Warren Buffett to pay for all the journalism, or Bill Gates. Aside from the idea that do we really want rich people in charge of our journalism like the Medicis, they don't have enough money with everything else they're doing. But we'll give our philanthropists and even smaller groups of funders a chance to launch a trial project. And then if it takes off, the people will support it. So it really makes it easy to be entrepreneurial. And then finally, the point you got at is, well, won't this lead to people wanting to have trashy stuff? Well, I think the evidence is pretty clear. And one only needs to look at public and community media to see the best evidence of this, that a lot of what drives the Jerry Springer and the most salacious material is the profit motive. It's commercialism. And if you strip that out, then this money will more likely go to journalism, especially without any copyright protection. And copyright protection for anything but journalism is very important. For journalism, it's not that important. I think it would likely lead to people doing coverage of their community without any government interference, but with the resources. It would also lead to a situation where if people want Jerry Springer, they'd still be there. There will still be commercial media. There will still be National Enquirer. There will still be Sports Illustrated. All our research shows that in those countries that have the largest public subsidies of journalism and of public media, the private media actually prosper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bob McChesney, John Nichols, there are two kinds of journalism that have to be saved, in my view, and I want you to explain how you do it. Mm-hmm. First is the news that wants not to be known, requiring investigation and time and skill and support. We just had a long conversation with Harold Evans, late of the Sunday Times of London, and his thalidomide story, for example. That took endless, endless work to dope out the damage of the morning sickness pill to pregnant women and their kids. But then the other category is news that challenges the common narrative, Operation Iraqi Freedom, or bigger narratives even of racial superiority, or WMDs, or the true history of Haiti, for example. That takes even more testicular fortitude and luck and narrative genius and heavy, heavy support from somebody. How would your system preserve the essential journalism?
Sure. It's a terrific question. And look, the first thing we have to understand, and I think it's very important to point out, is that nothing we're talking about is really rooted in saving the existing system, because the points that you just outlined, or many of the issues you just raised, we've already seen the failure of the existing system. It's not doing the job.
Right.
And so what we're talking about here, and it's something we have to be very careful on, we're not talking about saving the journalism we had. We are talking about creating a system, a media system, if you will, structures that can give us a much better journalism than we have had at any time in recent history, and maybe that we have ever had, or at least since the founding age of the Republic. And one of the things that is important to understand, I say this as a journalist, I know two things about journalism. One, there's almost no real investigative journalism. The term investigative journalism is one sort of – it's a fantasy created by editors who like to say, well, we're going to spend a lot of time on a topic and put a lot of money there. And so we're going to call it an investigation because that sounds sexy. Really what it is covering something over a long period of time, sticking to it. Watergate, for instance, was not investigative journalism. Watergate was taking two young reporters and saying, well, you're going to keep following this story for a long time. You're going to keep working on it. And they did for the better part of 2 years. And the term investigative, I think, actually harms us. What we really want to say is that we want a journalism that gives the resources to reporters to cover what a lot of folks may think about as either a boring or an ungettable story over a long period of time till they know the turf well enough, they're deep enough into it that they can crack the nut. And often the best investigative journalism or the best, you know, revealing journalism occurs when somebody's been on the beat for a long time and notices something that they weren't even looking for. And so bottom line is we've got to get to a point where our news media, be it online, in print, in broadcast, whatever platform it's operating on, has sufficient resources to do the job. What we have found, what we outline in the book, better part of two chapters on this, is that the commercial system that to some extent, although as we've agreed, insufficiently, practiced this kind of journalism in the 60s or the 70s, is completely leaving the field. It's no longer covering the world. The foreign bureaus are closing at an incredibly rapid rate. It's no longer covering Washington. There's whole agencies in Washington that are barely covered by commercial media. And so we're going to have to step in, and we're going to have to step in with huge amounts of resources. That's why when we talk about a subsidy, and that one of the things we say is that public and not-for-profit community media, some of these existing structures that are already here, they've been so starved. In America, we give public broadcasting roughly $400 million a year, right? In a European country, that's literally the coffee money for public broadcasting. It's a joke.
Hold off a sec on the matter of subsidies. I wonder if you are undercrediting the creative responses already blossoming on the internet. Let's take two stories that have been boiling around for the last couple of weeks. The Haiti earthquake, of course, and its aftermath. And then this Massachusetts Senate race that elected, to everybody's surprise, Scott Brown in Kennedy country. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with the coverage we've been getting, not only on C-SPAN, which is a kind of model of your publicly subsidized coverage, but also in endless public discussion on HuffPo or 538 where it comes mm-hmm. to politics or Politico, TPM? Don't we already see on the web the kind of enterprise and truth-telling and argument that you say is the essential of American journalism?
Well, we certainly see elements of it, and you just mentioned some of it. And John and I devote an entire chapter to reviewing some of the most interesting work that's being done on the internet. John's been blogging since the 90s, and I've been doing my version of it roughly the same amount of time. We live in the internet, so we certainly are aware of what's going on there. We rely upon the internet for much of our journalism now. But I think what we also show in the book is that as exciting as a lot of these new ventures are, we should be very concerned in a number of ways. First of all, much of the original material on the internet is based on old media reporting.
I question that, but go ahead.
Well, actually, the evidence supports what we just said. I
mean, well, the evidence of the newspaper advocates who say that, you know, if you trace down what we know, 85% of it comes from some newspaper reporter going out and seeing the tree falling or something. I don't buy that. I would also argue that when people say, you know, 70% of the people believe Saddam Hussein was behind the attack on the World Trade Center, a lot of that came out of newspapers. So in other words, a great deal of what we know comes from newspapers, but a great deal of it is wrong. In the case of...
Okay, but let me explain, because that wasn't my point. My point simply was that if you look at even a great blogger, someone we extol in the book, Glenn Greenwald, his work at Salon, much of Glenn's work comes out of starting with old media reports and critiquing them. He starts with what some reporter has done and says, this is a really good coverage. There are some weak spots, or here's really a bad coverage. And then he does extraordinary research online, drawing new stuff in and elevating it into a much better thing than what he began with. But I think the evidence is clear that a surprising amount of even the best stuff online, not to mention the bad stuff, the best stuff online starts at some point with a paid journalist connected to an old medium doing something that they're working off of. And I think the Pew study, which we like to talk about, which just recently came out, it was really an extraordinary confirmation of that phenomenon. And the Pew study that came out a few weeks ago basically did a study of the media of Baltimore and where the news came from in the city of Baltimore over an extended period in 2009. And what they found was they looked at where did the stories originate? What was the – where did they come from getting – how do we get them? And they found that 96% of all the original news stories, and we're just regurgitating what someone else had done, came from what we call old media. 4% from new media. They actually broke a news story. Now, that doesn't mean that new media didn't do a lot of Glenn Greenwald type stuff of taking an old story and shaping it, critiquing it, improving it, but they had to take something in the first place to work off of. They didn't, out of the blue, create the story other people responded to, except 4% of the time. And so that tells us that, you know, old media has played a significant role. Now, we're not exonerating old media, as you know. We're actually quite critical of old media because the rest of the study was quite damning. It found that of that 96% that old media are generating, most of it came from the Baltimore Sun Daily newspaper, but that the amount of stories that the Baltimore Sun was generating out of its newsroom of original stories had declined 30-some percent since 2000 and 73% since 1991. So we were in a situation in which old media wasn't generating a lot of original stuff, and new media wasn't generating very much original stuff, hardly any, and old media's amount was shrinking dramatically. And then finally, Chris, what was most astonishing, which basically we saw in all our research too in the book, was that you looked at then what did they base the stories on? Where did the stories come from that were being generated, the news stories of Baltimore? 86% came from public relations of one form or another. 14% were journalists generated. 86% came from a press release, something empowered at business or governmental. And what's striking about that is so we have a shrinking number of journalists providing a lot less journalism, but without very much resources to do original journalism. So it's increasingly turning into a process where they're taking press releases, what people in power want you to talk about. And maybe in some cases they're criticizing it, but they're letting them set the agenda. And it's worth noting that just a generation ago, all the research on what percentage, the balance of what news stories came from PR and what came from journalists going out and doing stuff was much more in the 50-50 range. And now it's 86-14.
Bob, I want to push back on those percentages some, but also when you say Baltimore Sun, I think David Simon. David Simon, formerly a reporter and editor of the Baltimore Sun, left the newspaper industry in anger and went out and founded The Wire on HBO, which didn't generate news items like there's a fire at 4th and Grand and somebody better get there, but it transformed our insight into reality in the city of Baltimore in that five-year series, a most extraordinary breakthrough. I think one could make an argument that David Simon was a much more productive, interesting, memorable creature in the broader journalism outside the newspaper into cable television finally. So I think you're underselling the creative destruction that's coming out of the death of newspapers and the good that's come of it. John Nichols.
David Simon disagrees with you strongly. In fact, we write about him at great length in the book. David Simon has testified before the U.S. Senate passionately about his fundamental concern about the crisis that occurs when we lose old media journalism. David Simon says that one of the things that he sought to illustrate with The Wire was the nightmare of a shutting down of a newsroom at a point when a city needs to be covered. And in particular, what he has suggested very, very passionately is that we cannot reduce the fundamental day-in, day-out work of covering a community and its civic life to a little bit of theater or to a lot of commentary, that somebody has to go and cover the zoning commission. Somebody has to go and dig into what's going on in the schools. This is not to say that we shouldn't have something like The Wire, which I agree with you, is fantastic. It's not to say that we shouldn't have all the commentary that's on the internet, but the fundamental gap that's occurring, and this is the democratic gap, the small d democratic gap that is opening, the void that is opening, is in the gathering of the information that power does not want us to have. Now, we believe in blogging. We believe in internet websites. We're passionate. We write at great length about them in the book. But one of the things that we point out is that because of a dramatic lack of resources and because of the almost complete inability of internet news sites and bloggers to make a living at what they do without some sort of support from someplace, not being advertising, not being the traditional sources. Because of this, it's just not doing the job. We have whole areas. You mentioned Haiti before, Chris, and I want to focus in on that. Do you know, before the earthquake hit, the entire U.S. media, the whole thing, had one correspondent on the ground in Haiti. Now, you can say, well, I mean, how could he have – he couldn't have told us an earthquake was coming. You're right about that. But the fact is that in the declining coverage of the world, not just by newspapers, radio, and television, but also, frankly, by the blogosphere. The blogosphere is not providing us with like some sort of greater coverage of the world. The fact of the matter is, in that decline, we are ending up with huge parts of this planet that are dark to Americans. Americans are cut off from them. And I'll tell you how different it was. Go pick up a copy of the Boston Globe or the Duluth News Tribune or whatever publication you want to from anywhere in America from 1960, and you're going to find a stunning amount of international coverage that was there, not always generated by that paper, sometimes by wire services, it's true. But you cannot imagine how much more coverage our grandparents had on the world than the average American, not the person who trolls the internet and like I do or you do or Bob does, hits 20 international sites a day. But the average American is getting dramatically less information about the world, which the United States so dramatically defines today, than our grandparents were.
John, my larger points would be that David Simon in The Wire went deeper in cable television in telling us the reality of life in Baltimore than any hundreds of newspaper stories did. Furthermore, that what's been missing in the coverage of Haiti is not just the detail of many correspondents covering that island, but the framework of an understanding that Haiti liberated itself from Napoleon in 1803, 1804, and has been paying France and the United States for its freedom ever since. I mean, cash until World War II. I mean, it has been bled in a bigger way that we were never conscious of, when all we knew of it really was that it's where they made, you know, big league baseballs, and a few people went for vacation. To me, it's the changing the big story that journalism has failed at, and that we're going to need new devices for doing. But move on. Go back to basics. You write fascinatingly of the moment after World War II, when in the Pacific, General MacArthur, and in Europe, General Eisenhower, both addressed the question that Germany and Japan would need new institutions of free press to have a new life. And they went in very confidently and clearly to set up those institutions. It's almost as if we need that kind of plan again, and we need that sort of confidence that we know how to do it. Where would you begin? In the spirit of Eisenhower and MacArthur in the sort of devastated public square.
Well, Chris, in the spirit of giving the context you thought we lacked in Haiti, let me give a context to this answer, which is that we've got to start from understanding that this is exactly what we did for the first 100 years in American history. We instituted enormous subsidies to create a much broader, richer, diverse, uncensored press system than we would have ever had otherwise. And possibly, I think, our electoral system, our Constitution wouldn't have survived without it. That's certainly what the Supreme Court has acknowledged in all its decisions on freedom of the press. So we put in place these massive postal and printing subsidies to the tune of what would be today worth roughly $30 billion if the federal government had the same subsidy as a percentage of GDP as we did routinely in the first half of the 19th century. And I mention this because when we first raised the issue of this, it went so against the grain of how Americans think of freedom of the press. It was like crazy talk. And we have the hard evidence. Now no one can deny it. But a year ago, when we first broached this issue, a person from one of those right-wing think tanks in Washington threw his fist down on the table and in his blog wrote, well, I'm with Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was completely against any government involvement in the press, period, no matter what. And so gets a copy of this book, and his response is, well, that was back then. It doesn't matter anymore. Who the founding fathers? Yeah, that was 200 years ago. Who cares about their experience? That has nothing to do with what we're doing today. So it's completely opportunistic. It's sort of like the facts only matter when it backs up whatever my argument is, which is not a legitimate form of inquiry or debate. And I think – but the point he was raising is, well, 200 years ago, conditions have changed. And so I think to put your point in context, context. Well, the American government has instituted a stunning subsidization creation of free press systems more recently in the 20th century, but they didn't do it in the United States. They did it in Germany and Japan immediately following the Second World War, in which case both Eisenhower in Germany, and MacArthur in Japan entered these countries, and they were had been ravaged by fascism and dictatorship. And they understood that if they were going to institute democratic systems that would actually survive and be functional, much like the founders of our country, they had to make sure there was a credible press system, independent, competitive, well-funded, providing the information the Japanese and German people needed so they could govern their lives and not be governed by elites or bosses. And they also understood that the commercial system absolutely would not work, that the owners of in the marketplace of Japan and Germany would not generate that journalism in the visible future. So they almost had a blank check policy to go out and open newspapers, set up public and radio and television systems, and give lots of journalists jobs covering Germany, every community in Germany, every community in Japan. And what we found in our research was extraordinary, was that they actually brought in American journalists to go in and say to the Japanese newsrooms, you've got to be critical of us. We're funding you, but if we're occupying your country, you won't have any credibility if you're just docile to people in power. The key thing to a free press is that you've got to be competing to keep us in line and keep people in power in line so you can actually govern those people.
That's fascinating. I mean, and that echoes Jefferson's delight and his kind of public mm-hmm. celebration of the people who were attacking him in mm-hmm. the same fashion.
There's a classic story from Jefferson that Jefferson said wonderful things about he'd rather have the newspapers than government, of course. But he also said he hated newspapers and just would rail against how horribly they treated him, how horribly they reported on him. And yet he was passionate about their existence and their freedom. As president, famously, in the outer vestibule of his office, he would have a stack of papers from around the country, and he would go out before a foreign visitor arrived and personally rearrange them to put the most critical papers on the top.
Yes, you're right, the ones that
said Jefferson has a slave mistress, Jefferson doesn't believe in God, all these things right on top. You know, nothing we know about Jefferson today wasn't reported in the press of his time. Hmm. This is what an activist, dissenting, challenging press does. But he would put the critical ones on top so that the foreign dignitaries who were visiting would see them first and maybe read them before they were ushered in to see the president of the United States. They would, of course, walk in and say, Mr. President, I can't believe you allow these things to be written about you. How shouldn't you put these people in chains? And Jefferson always looking for the teaching moment, frankly, much like a Ronald Reagan or a Franklin Roosevelt. Some of our most brilliant leaders realized that it wasn't all about just power. It was about teaching. Jefferson would use this moment. He would say, well, you see, that's what freedom of the press is about. That's what liberty is about, that you can criticize the most powerful person in the country, say what you want about them, because in this great discourse that we are opening up, the truth will out. I'll be okay. But it's the freedom that matters. And that was transferred to Germany and Japan. It's one of the reasons we write about it so much, because it was a point at which, in crisis, Americans were trying to not only create something, but also to teach about how we should think about journalism as a public good, as a necessity for civil society, for democracy. And I want to emphasize one other thing. It's coming full circle on this, on the Germany and Japan situation. The Americans who were there created not just one newspaper in a town. Even in smaller communities, they went out of their way to make sure that over time they developed both a liberal and a conservative publication, a socialist publication, and a Christian Democrat publication, so that they actually had a competition of ideas at the local level, because they believed not merely in having information, but having a real churning discourse about it. And when we wrote about it, it was so wonderful to write about this, because the romance of it, these Americans who went into Germany literally went into displaced person camps and would go, you know, building by building and yell into the rooms. Is anybody here, anybody who survived the concentration camps who is a journalist or who practiced something in this field? And if someone raised their hands, they'd talk to them. And often within days, that person would be editing a newspaper in Frankfurt or in Munich. There are stories of redemption and in the transfer of authority from the totalitarian to the oppressed, to those who have been most harmed. And in a sense, this is what we're talking about today. We have a society where huge parts of the American population is simply not covered. The poor, so many people of color who are really X'd out of our news in so many ways in this country, unless they get in the way of power. We need to create a media and a journalism and a communications in this country that doesn't just cover these folks, but that gives them the power to create their own media so that they can begin to have a coverage that is respectful and engaged.
Speak about the history of public broadcasting in this country as an example of public subsidy, about which some people are squeamish. They forget that William F. Buckley, most famous conservative in our society, was a creature, really, as a celebrity of public broadcasting. But what does it tell you about the vitality today of the sort of journalism you need? I've been feeling and hearing around internet circles for years that the internet is the new public. And I look around today and say, what are we hearing from public broadcasting, radio or television, really, that we don't hear much more pointedly, authentically, emphatically from free spirits on the internet?
That's a great question, Chris. And I think the follow-up on your point about William F. Buckley, it was Barry Goldwater, the father of the modern American conservative movement, who in 1984 said that public broadcasting was the only decent form of television in the country and that were advertising to come to it would destroy it. So this is – and I think what the Republicans have learned in the last 20 years is that once you get outside the Beltway, public broadcasting is quite popular with almost all Americans, even Americans who don't watch it, which is one of the things the research shows. Even working-class Americans who don't listen to NPR, don't watch PBS. In the polls, they want to support it, and they're willing to pay more to keep it because they love the idea that there's something out there that's non-commercial that's covering their community, even if they don't personally use it. But to get to your point about do we need it anymore, John and I have been very critical of public broadcasting journalism over the last 25 years, as we have with commercial journalism. We think it avoids a lot of the sensationalism, the trivia, the salaciousness of commercial journalism. But it also has some of the real problems of professional journalism as it's devolved over the last few generations in the United States. It's heavy reliance on people in power to set the terms of debate, what can be talked about, mm-hmm. what can't be talked mm-hmm. about. The heavy reliance on people in power for setting what can – you know. Not only the framing of the issue, but the very issue at all that can be discussed. You can't raise an issue people in power don't want to talk about. And I think the solution to that, though, isn't to get rid of the notion of public and community broadcasting, because I don't think that would solve the problem. The solution is to energize, make more democratic, make more diverse our public and community broadcasting and give them the resources to do it. Because I can tell you right now, if we go into community after community in the United States – and we'd gut out what remains of public broadcasting. All we're doing is burning down the last couple huts in a scorched landscape. We're not and again, the example here that's crucial. Oftentimes when people talk about public broadcasting or more broadly public subsidies at journalism, they say, well, the relevant comparison you must be thinking about, if we do go down that road, it's going to be Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or Pol Pot's Cambodia. You invariably going to lead to governments telling people what to think, and you're going to have a really sort of degraded information and a dictatorship. In our view, the real relevant comparison we should be looking at is a democratic nation with a constitution, with civil liberties, and with the traditions this great country has, is towards other democratic nations and what they are doing today and have been doing for the last generation to see, are there anything we can learn from them? And what's striking from our research, and we have in the book, and I think very few Americans are familiar with, is that almost all other major democratic nations have massive subsidies of journalism compared to the United States, extraordinarily large, both of public media, community media, and also explicit subsidies depending on the country to create second, third, and fourth newspapers in communities so you have a diversity of viewpoints. And when you look at that record, the real world record of other countries right now, you learn that we are fully capable of subsidizing an independent, vibrant journalism. It's there. The resources are there. The models are there. The record is there. All that's preventing us from doing that is this mythology we're wrapped up in that we can't do anything except pray that Wall Street can get rich doing it, and if they can't, we can't have a democracy.
I think that, well, we need the public media. We need public broadcasting, things like that. You're right. Many of the William F. Buckleys of today – and the Gore Vidals and the other commentators who once came to the fore in commercial and public broadcasting are today operating on the internet, and they're doing wonderful work. The fact is that most of us who blog and have success with it, where we really do get a lot of circulation, where we get picked up by members of Congress, our blogs quoted at congressional hearings and things like that. We've got a paying gig someplace. I have a paying gig at The Nation magazine. Glenn Greenwald has a paying gig. So many others have some sort of – Juan Cole. So many people are doing such great work on the internet. They've got something that's keeping them fed. What we are talking about with the many interventions that we discuss in the book, and we have a whole chapter on different strategies and different approaches, is finding ways to take these rising generations of brilliant commentators and great thinkers who are living on the web right now, but are often living hand to mouth, and saying, look, we want you to be sustained here. We want to make sure that you can do it and that it will work. We think it can, and we think that if you look, again, to these international models, one of the most striking things is that in places that have had large public subsidy for traditional media, they also have some of the most innovative build-out of new media and the most people living and working on the web and doing creative things there. And so we don't see a big barrier here, but we do see a great challenge. We think the William F. Buckleys of the 21st century are being starved, and also the Gore Vidals and all sorts of other commentators are being starved on the web. We want to get resources to them.
Take a fresh look at the internet and wonder if it isn't the answer to your whole question. You guys are dedicated to the idea of a public intervention, public investment, public subsidy, a gift from the government in a sense. But what if the internet is it? It brings down the cost of absolutely everything. What if the government's job here is simply to say, hey, by accident, through the Pentagon, we developed this huge new architecture of public communication. The costs are very, very low. It's not capital intensive anymore. You don't need presses. You don't need to, you know, deforest the planet to produce it. There's your subsidy right there. Anybody can enter. It doesn't need the same kind of public interest regulation as the public airwaves did because there's no scarcity at all. We're here. Go to it.
Great question, Chris. And there are really two important answers to that. First of all, if it worked, I'd say great. I mean, we're interested in what gets results. And if that were sufficient.
Well, it is working to the extent that, as you say, if Glenn Greenwald were the only fruit of the web, it would have justified itself by now. And I agree with you. Okay. Go ahead.
If it actually worked to generate the resources so we had 100,000 people who can cover their communities like we once had in this country rather than 50, we would be excited by it. If it served that function, we don't think the evidence is there that it will. And I think part of the reason for that is that the entire business model that sustained commercial journalism is collapsing with advertising. Advertising is no longer linked to support of journalism.
But we're not buying paper or delivering it in trucks or having all those expenses anymore.
Those expenses are gone, but there's one crucial expense that's still got to be paid, labor. That's the bottom line of journalism. You need people who can live, and there's no evidence we have the resources to pay for human labor. And we go through it in detail in Chapter 2. We've tried to find all the people who could make a living online purely doing journalism in the United States in 2010. And Chris, they can fit in this apartment pretty much, except for the ones who might – we're in an apartment. Should I let that out? We're in the studio. They can fit in this studio. And it's just a small number. Most people doing online journalism are getting bankrolled by an old media thing. And as they go down, they lose that income as a rule. That's not being compensated for. But if it did work, we'd be all for it. We want to give it resources so it can work. But there's a second issue there that's as important, which is the assumption you're making, which I think a lot of Americans make, that this notion of the internet as a largely free and ubiquitous enterprise, open to all, is built into the technology. It's just natural. It's just this gift from the Pentagon that they accidentally gave us. That's not true. We're learning, and we don't have to look at China or some other foreign government to see what they're doing. You can look right here with our cable and phone companies. The openness of the internet and its inability to be censored is due to policy, not technology. The technology doesn't prevent censorship. It's been the telecommunication policy of this country, which forced ISPs to treat all websites equally, that made it possible for me to go online or you to go online, for a conservative or left-wing, without anyone's permission. and have an audience, who anyone wanted to go to our website. That is in jeopardy being ended. We should keep what we have. We're not talking about changing it. They're trying to change it, to privatize it. They're hard at work at that right now. And unless we guarantee that, the premise of your question collapses. I think we have to guarantee and maintain the open internet. We have to have explicit policies and standards of public utility so we lose the class bias where a third of our nation is not connected to broadband and no one foresees it being connected to broadband in a generation because they're too poor and the companies don't make money servicing them. But even if we win those victories, which free press is fighting right now in Washington, we don't think that that's a necessary but not sufficient condition for journalism. There's no evidence yet that that will give us the resources so that next generation of journalists can just go online and support themselves. And we'll be left then with people who might have access to the internet. But our journalists will be primarily going to be people who either, one, are independently wealthy, or they somehow have spent a lot of time shaking down advertising micropayments instead of doing journalism. Or they basically are living in their basement or something. But it's not a credible system for a free society to govern itself, to leave journalism to that sort of institutional non-structure.
John Nichols.
There are some staggeringly dangerous discussions going on right now as regards the internet. And the most dangerous is this discussion of creating it's essentially a multi-tiered internet, right? One for the elites. And one where you can really get all the freedom you want on it. But another one which is much more constrained and much more limited and where you really have an information superhighway for commercial and economic elites, a dirt road for the dissenters. And that can be done within the current frame if the policies are done wrong. That's the first danger. But the second danger, and I think – and this is the one it's still a failure of imagination – with regards to the internet. Many of the people who are defining how you're going to do news on the internet, even folks at the New York Times, are talking about, well, we're going to have to charge a little bit. We're going to have a little bit of a toll to get to that information because it's right that somehow you have to pay for it. Well, the problem with this is it defeats the entire point of the internet. Right? When you have paywalls and you make it hard to leap from place to place, you create a situation that is dysfunctional on the internet. The genius of the internet is I find an article and I see something in it that's great, and then I tap on a link and I go to something else and I keep digging and having this great adventure of knowledge. But those who speak of paywalls, those who speak of all the barriers and gates they want to put on the internet, all structural realities are really undermining the potential of this medium. And this is one of the things that Bob and I keep coming back to. The debates that we are having now about how people will get information in the 21st century, the quality of that information, how they'll use it, what they'll do with it, these are the debates that any free society should have. But more often than not, we don't have them. More often than not, they occur in back rooms through policy-making discussions with one lobbyist saying, well, I want this, another lobbyist saying, I want that, the people left out of the process. The whole point of our book and why we subtitle it with that great Tom Paine quote, the media revolution that will begin the world again, is that right now we are in a 1776 moment. And in this 1776 moment, we, the people, need to have that hyper level of engagement with every one of these policy debates, net neutrality, how we get news, how we structure it, whether we have to subsidize, how we would subsidize, because everything that's old is falling apart and everything that's new can be built at a civic and democratic level, or it will be built at a commercial and entertainment level. If it's commercial entertainment, it will not serve democracy.
I have another very big picture challenge to the whole story. Chris Hedges, whom I love and I think you do too, mm-hmm. argues that our whole culture and psychology now as a nation is hostage to illusion. This from his book, Empire of Illusion. But that we're hostage to a video culture of imagery and sensation that is less and less literate, and pretty seriously disconnected from the reality of where we stand in the world, our debts, mm-hmm. our economic position. Are we still capable of a robust public conversation to deal with that?
Oh, absolutely. And I've had Chris on my own radio show, and I've read the book, and I love the book, and I'm going to teach the book in my classes. And I think what he presents really is a post-journalism future. He presents the world we're in and entering, rapidly entering,
yeah.
in which you have a world in which power is largely unaccountable, and you have circuses of various sorts to entertain the masses. And it's a very frightening view of where we are, where we're heading rapidly, and makes, in my view, the urgency of the project John and I are talking about that much more apparent in what we have to do. Now, the question is, you know, is it hopeless? As Chris might suggest or imply, or one might draw from looking at his book, it might not be his argument, the mass of people in this country so content or deluded or satisfied with the current diet that they are uninterested or unwilling to change or to embrace a different future or to pursue what the necessary reforms that to give us the journalism we need and have self-government and genuine democracy. There, I'm much more optimistic. And I base the optimism not on a seminar room or a bar stool conversation, but rather on the work we've done at Free Press for the last 8 years and the work that John and I have been doing in the last year on this journalism issue. What we learned, and I think it's a lesson that many intellectuals and academics and journalists even don't quite get, because their contact with people is cab drivers, then people like themselves, and otherwise they draw to sort of inferences about people from indirect experience. But we've learned from our experiences that if you talk to people as if they're really smart and intelligent and care about these issues, you find out that a lot of people are really smart, intelligent, and care about these issues. If you regard people as just these dummies who watch pornography and professional wrestling and listen to loud music and regard people like that, you find out that they're going to regard you as someone they don't want to deal with and that you don't relate to their world. And we're quite optimistic. In this tour, we just published the book a few weeks ago. We have not yet had a room that wasn't standing room only in big halls. And these aren't just, you know, college professors and journalists. We're going out into the hinterlands. You know, we haven't been to New York or Washington yet. And what we're finding is people are desperately concerned about the lack of information. And we're living in a world now in which our economy is in deep crisis. Our foreign policy is in deep crisis. We have a generation of kids, including my daughter, who's graduating college in a few months, who are entering a world in which the economy has never been worse since the 1930s for them. And this is a world in which you need journalism. You need to understand what's going on, or you aren't going to solve these problems. This isn't an era you can just sort of go to the beach and sit back and say, well, I'll let the next generation worry. I think that we have people who desperately are interested in these issues, but they've got to be engaged at that level.
That is hugely encouraging. Mm-hmm. One of my mentors in journalism, Richard Reeves of the New York Times, said that what television learned in 50 years since the Kennedy-Nixon debates was that this country is more interested in football, really, than in politics. So maybe the wrap-up question, John, is, I mean, do we know how to build a tough-minded, realistic, argumentative, political debate again? The sort of open, street-smart, inquiring, and somehow still civil wrangling of the kind that Jefferson and Thomas Paine and their guys had in mind at the start?
Sure we do. It's not that hard. You know, I think that those of us who worry so much about these challenges that Chris Hedges outlines, that you outline so well, and that Bob and I live every day, I wish I could let you ride in the car with Bob and I or in the plane. We never stop talking. And we are always talking about politics and about policy, and often not just media, but the broader challenge. And to be honest, of the many challenges that we face as a society, the challenge of building a robust democracy-sustaining media landscape in this country, making one that really can work, is one of the easiest ones. It requires some money. We outline in the book the suggestion that all of the subsidies we're talking about, at least, you know, a lot of public media, some money to sustain not-for-profit, low-profit, all this. When we talk about it all, we're talking in the range of $30 billion. And people go, oh, $30 billion. Well, that's about 3% of the bank bailout. That's about what we spend in 10, 12 weeks in Iraq. In the overall scheme of things, it's not very much to actually know about the bank bailout and to actually know about Iraq. And with that, we could open up a huge journalistic bonanza, if you will, an information bonanza. And we know from other countries other countries are very much like us in a lot of ways. They have different problems, different challenges, but places that we can imagine emulating or even doing better than, that it's doable, it's achievable. This is more of a question of will and of popular engagement. Bob cited the crowds that have showed up for our events. That's the most exciting thing. You know, when you write a book, you know, you have all these ideas that you've lived with in a room for a very long time, and then you go out to the people. And the question is, are they going to show up? Are they going to be excited and engaged? The biggest problem we have is once we open up this dialogue, when we say to people, you can define the media systems of the 21st century, not Rupert Murdoch, not some CEO. You can be the defining force, much as the founders said in 1792. When you say that to people, the most amazing thing happens. They take over. We, the authors and the activists, we get to step back, and the people get excited, and young people start talking about, wow, if we have a News AmeriCorps, you know, like with teachers, but now we're going to send young journalists into undercover communities. Well, I could do that. And then they start saying, well, maybe if a bunch of my friends and I got together, we could actually create a website that covered a low-income neighborhood or that took a school radio station and made it a community radio station. The bottom line is the excitement level of giving the definition of what our media is back to the people is so engaging that what you suddenly find is the people aren't, they aren't stupid, they aren't disinterested. They haven't been asked for so long that when you ask them, when you go and say, would you like to create a media that can make you, and especially that can make your children, stronger, better, bolder citizens than we've ever known? They say yes, and a lot of them are ready to step up and do the job.
John Nichols and Bob McChesney, it's a huge pleasure to see you face-to-face and to engage in these issues. This is enormously encouraging news in your book. Thank you for The Death and Life of American Journalism, the media revolution that will begin the world again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited our conversation with Bob McChesney and John Nichols. At Brown University, Ben Mandelkern and Hannah Olson are our models of up-and-coming journalism. Pitch your own angles on the music of democracy at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.